Welcome back to Stacktrace, the podcast that is all about life and technology from two developers' perspectives. And who are those two developers then, you might ask? Well, it's me, John Sundell, and my good friend, Mr. Guy Rambo. How's it going, Mr. Rambo?
I'm doing great. For a moment, I thought it wasn't going to be me because you were wondering so much about those two developers.
Yeah, maybe I was building up to some kind of surprise. It's like, this week, it's not with John and Rambo. It's with some completely different people.
That would be weird given that I control the cast recording session.
Yeah, it really would be strange. So if I sound a little bit different here to you or to our listeners, it's actually because I'm in my new office.
Oh, nice.
I just moved in my apartment, actually, so I haven't moved to a new place, but we just flipped the two rooms here, so our bedroom turned into my new office, and my old office turned into our new bedroom. It just turned out to be better that way for now, where we get a little bit more room because the previous office was a little bit larger. So now I have a slightly smaller office, but it's really cozy, really nice. I'm very, very happy about it. But I haven't gotten like the full audio proofing setup here just yet. So if I sound a little bit more echoey or something than usual, then that's why. I apologize, but it's probably just going to be for this episode because I think by the time we record our next episode, everything will be fully kind of studio transformed as it should be.
And this is the stuff we always tell people on podcasts just so they don't think you're like recording from the bathroom or something.
Exactly. And I'm not on some secret assignment, right? Like there's no mystery. It's just I'm in my new office and I just haven't gotten like the audio foam and everything up on the walls just yet. You know how it is when you have a project like this, it like goes on and on. It's kind of funny where moving just between two rooms here in the same apartment was actually almost the same amount of work as moving to a different apartment because I had to pack everything down into boxes and we were repainting and doing some other kind of construction work and assembling new furniture and so on. So everything kind of needed to be packed into boxes. So it was kind of like moving, although I was just moving like 10 meters instead of moving, you know, many, many kilometers away. It was just really funny how It's the problems are kind of the same, even if you're just moving within the same actual apartments.
Yeah, I've gone through the same thing here when I was doing a little bit of remodeling for the studio display setup that I have now. It's really quite a lot of work. And I've seen a picture of your new office, which looks great, by the way. It looks, like you mentioned, really cozy. I like the floor, that it's a little bit lighter. And the whole design of the office, I think it looks really neat. So congratulations on your decorations on the office. But I've also noticed that you seem to have a new desk, which is a standing desk. And I don't remember if you were using one before, but I don't think so, right?
No, before we actually had like a dining table, more or less, as our desk shared between me and my girlfriend. It was like a large wooden table that we were both sitting at, which was really, really neat when we were sharing that working space together. But now I have a desk just for me, and it's indeed a standing desk. I got the Jarvis standing desk, which is a very popular model. I just searched for different standing desks and were like doing some research, and this one seemed to be very highly recommended by a lot of people. So I just got this one. It's like 140 centimeters wide. It's it goes up and down because it's a standing desk. And in fact, I am standing right now.
Nice.
And having a standing desk again, which I haven't had now for a few years, it's really, really nice. Like I've actually been standing up most of the time since I got this desk, and it's just really energizing to be able to stand up and work, especially if you're like listening to some nice music and you're doing some coding. It's really, really neat to have a standing desk. So I haven't had this desk for long, so I can't do like a full review of it yet. I think maybe we can do that in a few months once I've kind of gotten to know this desk a little bit better and actually have been using it quite a bit. But so far, like very, very good first impressions. The desk is really, really nice. It looks great. It's very, very sturdy, even though it's a standing desk, and it can go quite tall as well. And the assembly process was really fun as well. It was almost like assembling a Lego set. It was like, because you had to connect all these motors and everything for the actual like lifting mechanism for the desk. And I also had some kind of wiring that I wanted to do. So I wanted to like make the wires go neatly beneath the desk. I have this kind of basket that they all go into that came with the desk that I had to attach. And yeah, it was a whole project, but it was really, really fun. And that even makes the office even nicer now, because I feel like I kind of built it myself, even though it was all from just assembling IKEA furniture and this Jarvis standing desk.
Of course, it had to be IKEA.
Of course, of course. Swedish person always has to have at least some IKEA in his house, right?
Yeah, yeah. A standing desk is really nice. I can agree with that. I've been using one for probably over 2 years now, and I do stand a good period of the day. Not always during recording, it depends on the day, but I will sometimes record while standing, which is really nice as well. And it's easier to better project your voice when you're standing up, but I'm not standing today because I'm feeling a bit lazy today, but yeah, I really like having a standing desk. And I agree with the cable management. I don't have the wire basket that you have, but when I did this remodeling here, I did a bunch of cable management, but it's mostly just zip ties basically. But the important thing is that there aren't like a bunch of wires hanging below the table, which can become real messy and ugly.
Yeah, absolutely. And for me, like having a very clean desk, both in terms of the kind of aesthetics or the design and the wiring and all of that, those things, but also like I don't eat at my desk. I don't keep like a bunch of stuff on it. I don't like keep old soda cans or something on the desk. Like I try to keep it really clean. This is for me very important for just like my, I guess like just well-being. Like I feel very stressed when I'm in a like messy environment. Yep. Like I like things to be neat. I wouldn't call myself like a quote-unquote neat freak or anything like that. Like I sometimes things are messy and that's fine, especially like we were doing this remodeling, things were very messy in the house during that time, but I like things to be kind of, you know, all in place. That's when I feel like I can do my work in the best way.
Yeah, I don't like to have a bunch of visual clutter on my desk, which can become a mess when you have like a bunch of, even if it's just like a bunch of iPhones or a bunch of AirPods in my case. So usually when I'm doing something that requires having a bunch of devices out, I'll just do it while I need to do it, and then I'll put the devices away and get my desk to be as clean as possible. I like to have up on my desk only the stuff I really need and nothing else, and no visual clutter basically, because I like you, I feel kind of stressed out and distracted when there is a bunch of stuff on top of my desk. It's like the desktop on your computer, right? I don't like having icons on my desktop. I only have stuff in there when I'm actively working with something that doesn't need to have a permanent place yet. But as soon as I need a permanent place, or as soon as I'm done with it, I'm cleaning up my desktop. And same goes for the physical desktop.
Yeah, both your physical desktop and your digital desktop should all be like neat, right? Like that's, yep, that's a very nice way to do it. And, you know, this is, of course, a very kind of strange problem to have, if you will. Like it's a very good problem to have in a way, where when we are doing iOS development, we usually have quite a number of devices that we need to use, right? Especially if you're building an app, like I'm working on several projects that need to run, you know, on different hardware, like iPhones and iPads, of course. And I need to use older versions as well, so that I make sure that my app has good performance, even if it's running on older device. So it requires me to have quite a bunch of devices like around regularly be able to test on. And the trade-off there then is like, okay, do you keep all of those things on your actual desk? But that, you know, doesn't look very neat, at least not according to me. And also, like, devices like that, they just gather dust so much, right? Like, they're real dust magnets. So another neat thing I did here in the new office is that I have this little box for my test devices that I have in a shelf behind me. So it's like just at arm's length behind me, so I can quickly get my test devices, but I don't have to look at them all day. And also I can close that box so that they don't get really dusty. And yeah, it just feels like solutions like that, that just make your work, not necessarily like, oh, it makes you work faster or something like that, but it just makes the work a little bit more neat and nice. Like I think those kind of quality and life improvements can be very, very good to make when you're working like this from home, like every single day.
Yeah, I do have as well. I have a drawer right behind me with all of my iPhone, and there's even an Android device in there. And the AirPods and other headsets I have behind me on a shelf. I have like a pile of AirPods and also some other headsets that are hanging in support and whatnot. I do want to do something about that, make like a nicer display just for it being nicer, not because I need that, because I'm not looking at it while I'm using my computer because it's behind me. But yeah, it's just nice to have these little nice things that you can look at sometimes. Like, I just got the app icon book thing. Are you aware of that book?
Yeah, absolutely. It was made by a friend of mine, Michael Flerup, really great app icon designer himself, and he now made this book. I haven't gotten mine yet, but I hear so many great things about it, and I've seen some people posting pictures from it online and so on, and it just looks like a really, really nice project.
Yeah, it became a piece of furniture here, not because I don't want to look at the book, quite the opposite. I didn't want to just like look at the book and look at the icons once and then throw it in a shelf, right? So I actually put it on display here because it's such a nice looking book, and even the cover is nice, but you can even like open it up in a random page and leave it open because it's all so nice in there. So many nice app icons.
Awesome. Yeah. Can't wait to get mine. Haven't ordered it yet even, so I will look into doing that soon.
Awesome.
So besides my little remodeling project here and moving offices in my apartment, I have, of course, also been keeping up with work and doing quite a bunch of development work lately. And one thing that I've also been picking up again is my SwiftUI-based game project.
Ooh.
So Rambo, you and our listeners might remember that a few months ago we were talking about that I've been building this strategy game using SwiftUI, which is running across all of Apple's platforms, more or less, not on the watch just yet, but on the Mac and iPad, iPhone, of course, and so on. And SwiftUI has just been super great in this context in general. I was really, really surprised by just how well it was performing, and I was able to get the game up and running at a really, really smooth frame rate, like 60 frames per second solid, with lots of objects on the screen and so on, like all with that declarative SwiftUI syntax, which I really didn't expect. And we did cover that a few months ago when we talked about this for the first time. But now then I picked it up again, and it still is great to use SwiftUI in this context. And one thing that also kind of came to mind as I was working on this again for the first time in a few months was I felt like the project, the way I had organized it, was actually really, really neat. And it enabled me to get back into this project really, really quickly. And that hasn't been the case with previous hobby projects for me, where when I work on hobby projects, very often I will write the code in a kind of more hacky way, if you will, or I will just kind of not think too much about architecture and I will just kind of throw things together because, well, it's a hobby project, right? Like, you don't know where it's going to go. You don't even know if you ever want to ship it. It might just be a prototype. It might just be something you do for fun or to learn or something like that. So you don't want to spend too much time kind of just on the kind of structure of things. You just want to write some code, do the thing you want to do, and kind of go on from there. But this time around, I did want to spend some time on actually establishing a neat architecture for this project, because I felt like I did want to work on it, not maybe like every week or something, because I don't feel like I have the time for that. And it is still 100% a hobby project, but I still felt like I wanted to work on it kind of semi-regularly. And I wanted to be able to just jump in and get some stuff done, just like in my client projects and other kind of commercial projects I work on, where I have a very good structure. So it's easy for me to kind of jump from project to project and kind of reorient myself when I do that because of that solid structure. But so I wanted to do that with this hobby project as well. And it felt like it actually really paid off because, like I mentioned, previous hobby projects I've been working on, it's very often that I open up the code base and I kind of like, I felt this motivation to work on it. But as soon as I opened up the Xcode project, I was like, I don't know where I was. I don't know where I was working before. I don't know what this code is doing here. This code looks broken. This code looks too buggy and so on. Even if just a few months have passed, like, it's easy to forget about these things. And I'm just very happy that this wasn't the case here. And I just wanted to kind of bring it up to say, maybe we should all, like, I should definitely, like, I'm learning from this that I should try to structure my hobby projects in a more kind of production way, like I'm doing when I'm working on client projects. And I feel like this could be a learning for many people, where I feel like it's very, very common to do what I was doing, where you really just kind of hack your hobby projects together And then you have a hard time going back to them because of that kind of hackiness of the project.
Yeah, I think there's a distinction, though. I don't think maybe production is the right word in this case. So the way I do things, because I've been doing this for quite a while, of actually like not skimping on things like having appropriate types and access controls and taking care of those things in my hobby projects or things that I do to just prototype or test something. What I do skimp on is handling of edge cases. Like I will force unwrap things, force try things. Those sorts of things I do skimp on when I'm doing this sort of project. But actually, like the structure and the organization in general, not so much. What I will do sometimes is like, instead of having everything neatly separated into different files and stuff, I will just have like one big Swift file with all of the implementations in there, just because it's quicker to try things out and change things. But as soon as I know that this is becoming anything more than just a little prototype, I will start breaking things up into files and putting in the appropriate like private and public and whatnot. But what I do allow me to do is not worry about error handling and force unwrapping and those sorts of things that can make Swift more bureaucratic to use. And those sorts of things, of course, you should take care of for production and also the handling of edge cases. But for a hobby project, not so much. But I do agree that in terms of actual, like having some resemblance of an architecture or something that can help you get back to the project later is a good way to ensure that you're not going to abandon your hobby project.
Yeah, exactly. And I think you're absolutely right there that perhaps it's not so much about the like production quality of the actual logic, but more like production quality in terms of structure, right? Or yeah. Like you're structuring the project in a way that you would in a quote-unquote real project or like in a commercial project, but you're not spending too much of your time worrying about, like you said, edge cases or like fixing every single bug or making sure that everything runs super smoothly. You're more focused on kind of just getting things done or validating kind of your theory that you might have or whatever it is that the project is for. And I also think that you bring up a very useful distinction there between a hobby project and a prototype.
Yep.
Where a hobby project doesn't necessarily have to be a prototype, right? Like, and that's usually the first phase of every project, including commercial ones. I love to build prototypes even for new features within client projects, just to kind of validate the structure, validate the idea, send something to the client behind a feature flag so that they can check it out, so that they can give me early feedback, and then I can kind of build the thing in a real way. Like I still feel like that is a great way to kind of get started with many different kinds of projects, is to do a very quick prototype. And then I do exactly what you just said. I just write everything in a single Swift file. I don't care about anything when it comes to code quality, because it's all about just like getting something on the screen. Like that's the only thing I'm caring about at that point. So this is when the project goes from being that prototype where you're just building something really, really quickly to actually being a real project. But in this case, it's a hobby project that I know I will not be able to work on every single week or something, and not regularly. So I'm kind of preparing myself or preparing the project for that by structuring it in a neat way so that I'm able to dive quickly back into it whenever I have like a few hours to spare. And that was the case this time. And it really worked out where I was able to like build a couple of new features, actually like move the game forward and get things up and running, even if it just was for a few hours that I was working. And I'm just always very happy when I feel that some kind of investment like this, whether it's like unit tests or code structure or architecture, when I feel like it pays off so quickly. Because very often, like when you're doing these exercises of like, let me cover everything with unit tests, let me write things in a very proper way and have good abstractions and name my classes and everything very well, you very rarely get this kind of immediate feedback from that. It's more like you can feel good about it and you know that you did things properly and that feels good. But it's often like you don't know about the bugs that you prevented, right?
Yeah.
Like you don't know about the bugs that your unit test might have caught that you didn't ship to production. Like you don't usually get that kind of feedback. So when you do, in this case, like when I really felt like this work that I did to structure the project in a neat way actually really paid off so quickly, that just always feels really good.
Yeah, definitely. I do agree. And at the same time, it's important to note that this doesn't mean that we are expecting everyone to have these really pristine hobby projects and it's just perfect with all of the architectural stuff taken care of and unit tests for everything. Absolutely not. And I think it's important to highlight here because it's one of the things I see people struggle with a lot, especially younger developers who talk to me. They say that they don't get too far with the projects they do because they get caught up in these sorts of things. And I'm always here to say that like it's completely fine for you to just hack together something that works and that looks good and that helps you learn and try out things in the operating system or some idea that you've had. So don't feel like you have to do this. It's highly personal as well. Like it's the way I like to do it and the way John likes to do it. But do whatever works for you and don't feel like your side projects have to be perfect or be production ready or architected in the perfect way, because I do see a lot of people struggling with that and where that worry ends up making it so people don't get too far with their project, which is a shame.
Yeah, I think that's a very, very good point you bring up. And like I mentioned earlier as well, is that hobby projects are usually a very good way to learn new things, where especially if you're working on, let's say you're working on an iOS app as your day job, but it's completely based in UIKit and you want to learn Swift UI, you might not be able to start introducing Swift UI into your kind of day jobs app. Like it might not be possible because of whatever reason. And then it can be a great way to learn Swift UI is to build something on the side. Like if you have time for that and if you want to do that, it's also worth to point out that you don't have to have hobby projects to be a good developer, right?
Yep.
Like it's all about what you want to do. Like a hobby project should be, like the name says, a hobby. It should be fun. It shouldn't be something that you feel like you must do. It should be a fun thing. So it can be a fun way to learn, for example, Swift UI or anything else. And then, of course, like you just said, Rambo, you don't want to worry too much about the structure because that's really just going to slow you down. You need to make those mistakes and learn from them and see what works for you and what you like when it comes to these new technologies. And a hobby project can be a great way to do that. And then you might just need to prepare yourself for, well, either the code base might be a bit messy and you're fine with that, or you might go back and like rewrite certain things or clean them up afterwards. And that's, of course, completely fine as well. So it depends on kind of what you feel like you want to do with your hobby project, what you want to kind of plan for, and how you're looking to work on it, and also, of course, what your goals are and what you're actually building it for.
Exactly.
So to talk a little bit more concretely about the structure then, and this will also kind of segue us into another topic that I really wanted to talk to you about this week, which is how I'm kind of modeling my data when I'm using Swift UI, where in the beginning, when I started using Swift UI, I felt like the concept of view models was very, very compatible with Swift UI. And I still feel that way. I think having that single view model in your view that is an observable object that you can observe in your Swift UI view, where you can put all of your logic outside of your view hierarchy, is great. Like, I really, really like that in general. And I've tried doing that, you know, in UIKit as well, but even more so, I would say, in Swift UI to not put any logic in my actual views, because my views are just structs. They're just descriptions of my UI in Swift UI. I don't want to have any kind of lifecycle there, any kind of logic or any sort of thing that I need to manage inside of those views, because I want to be able to treat them just as those descriptions, those values that they are. So I don't want any kind of quote-unquote business logic inside of those Swift UI views. So I want it elsewhere. And a view model can be a great kind of companion to a Swift UI view, where you can just put your logic there that relates to this specific view, and you can do all your kind of networking and database logic and all of those things in that view model. You can unit test it separately. You can just consume it inside of a view, just read the properties from the view model and render your UI, and that is fantastic. So that's an approach I've been using quite a bit, but one thing that I've become more and more kind of in favor of as I've been using Swift UI, both for this game project, but also for lots of production apps and client projects where I'm also using Swift UI these days, where I don't necessarily have one view model for every view. And in fact, introducing a view model for me is a very deliberate choice, and it's not something I do automatically directly. Like, I don't follow necessarily like MVVM, like model, view, view model, I don't necessarily follow that like super strictly where it's like, that's my entire architecture. Instead, I just treat view models as a tool in the toolbox. And I know I've said this about other technologies before as well. Like, this is my general kind of architectural philosophy, is that I don't feel like I want to have too strict of a prescribed way of building every single view in my app. I do want consistency, but I would rather have like a couple of tools in the toolbox that I can pick from. Not too many, like a limited set of tools, but I don't want necessarily every view to be written the exact same way, because very many views in different projects are very different and they have different needs. So in this game project, for example, I don't have any view models at all. Instead, I have different controllers that you could say, well, aren't they almost just like view models where I am observing those controllers in my views? But they're a little bit different because they can then be shared between multiple views, and then multiple views can kind of observe that same state from that controller without tying it to one specific view as a view model. And I've been thinking about, like, should I then introduce a view model anyway as kind of a intermediate between those controllers and those views? But I felt like that was just kind of adding unnecessary boilerplate or adding unnecessary abstractions that really didn't need to be there. I felt like it was fine to have those controllers be observable objects and directly be injected into those multiple views that needed to observe them. And that's also the strategy I've been using in some client projects, where there are these kind of services and controllers that I need to observe. And rather than introducing a view model as a layer between, just for the sake of it, I just observe those objects directly in certain views, while other views that are more complicated and have specific view logic that I need to write, that's when I will introduce a view model. So I just wanted to bring this up as kind of like my thoughts around how I typically like work with view models in projects, because I sometimes feel like reading, for example, my SwiftUI based articles, some people might get the impression that I use view models all the time, because I very often bring that up as an example. And I do love view models, and I do use them quite a bit, but not necessarily for every single view or not necessarily for every single project.
Yeah, and the view model is just a name, really. So if you renamed your controllers to whatever view model instead of whatever controller, they would technically be view models. So there's a lot of nomenclature stuff around this as well.
Well, yeah, I guess. I mean, at the end of the day, these are all just names, right? Yeah. You can name them whatever. You could name them manager or service or context, your favorite name, Rambo. You know, there are just so many different ways you can name things, of course. But for me, at least, when I work with a view model, I kind of want that to have a one-to-one relationship to a view. Mm-hmm. And when I start sharing these observable objects between multiple views, like between different kind of features in the app, and I'm passing things around, I don't want to call that a view model anymore. I feel like that's kind of misleading, where if I open up a Swift file and it's called, for example, profile view, and then I see profile view model, I assume that these two have a one-to-one relationship. They work together to render the profile view. Yep. While if that profile view model then ends up in like the shopping cart view, for example, like that for me feels wrong.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do agree. And with that out of the way, I do a very similar thing. And I think the best way to describe when a view model comes into play is, so let's say you have like a shopping cart controller, which is talking to your API and it's fetching the items and whatnot. But in your view, you want to display the items filtered in a certain way that's specific to that view, or sorted in a specific way that's just for that view. Or you have a different type of data that you want to transform those cart items into something else that the view expects. I think that's where a view model comes into play, because you don't want to put that view-specific logic in your more general cart controller thing, or manager, mm-hmm. or context, or whatever, like you mentioned. And at the same time, you don't want to have all of this business logic of sorting and transforming and all of that stuff in the view code itself, because it can become messy very quickly. And of course, you can't test that without instantiating a view and things like that. So it becomes a mess. So I think that's where it comes into play. And something that I have been doing as well is when I have the need for reference semantics in something that a view is going to use. So say I'm like integrating with some system API and I need to like implement a delegate or something, but it's very focused on this particular view type, I will sometimes nest the controller type within the view itself. Mm-hmm. So it's going to be like my view.controller, and the controller will even sometimes be private. And I will do that within that little controller. But this is for very small like needs, not for like this controller will probably have just a couple of methods and like a property that the view observes. If it's anything more than that, then you need to do some rethinking. But yeah, that's also something I've been doing to like indicate in a very explicit way that this controller thing object that I made is just for this view and this view only, and it should never be used outside of this context.
Yeah, I think that's really neat. And in fact, this is a pattern that SwiftUI itself uses for UI view representable and UI view controller representable and the NS equivalents on the Mac as well, where there's this coordinator API, not to be confused with like a coordinator that people sometimes use for navigation in UIKit-based apps, yeah. But a coordinator that coordinates that specific instance or that underlying UI view or UI view controller and talks to SwiftUI and coordinates that relationship, where just because you create a new SwiftUI struct, of course, doesn't mean that you want to recreate the underlying UI view, so that you can then use that coordinator object to have that object that lives alongside of your UI view, and you can use that for things like delegates and kind of Objective-C based patterns, for example, target action and so on, that you can't use a struct for, so you can just use the coordinator there. And that works the same way as what you just described. You have that nested type. In this case, it's called a coordinator, not a controller. But again, you know, same thing, but different names, more or less. So I think that approach can work really well. I think it works well up to a point where if this controller or coordinator starts becoming a little bit more complex, then I might feel like I want to break that out into a separate file. But it can also be really neat to have everything related to one view in a single file, because you can then just scroll up and down when you want to iterate on it. So you don't have to like figure out where is this thing in the code base. It's all right there. So up to a point, I think, up to a certain point of complexity, that can work really, really well.
Yeah, and actually, it's good that you mentioned the representable stuff, because that's where I borrowed the concept from. Like, not like they invented nested types for that, but it was through my usage of NSView representable and stuff like that that I realized, maybe this could be a good pattern to use for these small controller-ish objects that I need. So yeah, I borrowed it from that.
Yeah, super cool. And to kind of round off this topic then, so what I kind of wanted to say with this was that I think that, like I've said before, I think when you're designing an architecture for an app, it's all about like the goals of the project or your preferences, of course, and what kind of metaphors that you want to use. But I think it's important to be a little bit more dynamic in our kind of thinking about these things and to not be too strict or to say like, if I'm going to adopt view models, then every single view needs to have a view model, because I feel like that can kind of be counterproductive. Yeah. And like I mentioned, going back now to this game project, because I had that solid structure, which wasn't based on view models, it was based on controllers that were shared between different views, but I had picked some kind of structure, right? Like you could call it MVC if you want to, but it's really just SwiftUI views plus controllers. So it's like, I guess, VC? Well, I do have models also. So let's just call it MVC. And that just gave me that very quick mental map of saying, okay, if I want to modify the game logic, I just go to the controllers. If I want to modify the way the game is rendered, I go to the views. So it was very easy for me to kind of reorient myself after being gone from this project for like 2 months. And I think that's really kind of the point of an architecture, right? Is to give you that map that you can use to browse the project so you know where things are supposed to belong, and so that you can reorient yourself when you are coming back, or if someone new is joining the project, they can also kind of orient themselves in where things are and how to work with the code base.
Yeah, exactly. And with all of that said, I'm still very much not completely decided on what my preferred way to approach SwiftUI app architecture is. Like, I haven't really released any app that's fully SwiftUI based, so most of my SwiftUI code is self-contained in a sense. And when I do like my side projects that are apps entirely based on SwiftUI with the SwiftUI app lifecycle and things like that, I'm still very much unsure and always changing my mind about how do I handle navigation? How do I store stuff, where do things belong. So if you feel that way as well, you're not alone. You are a dear listener.
Yeah, and it's kind of funny where I don't think we can expect to just like almost 3 years now into the whole Swift UI journey. And of course, not every developer has even started using Swift UI yet, or some people might have started using it 6 months ago or something. Like, we can't really expect to have decided exactly what architecture we want to use for forever, like just in that short period of time, because we're still debating how to architect UI kit-based apps,
exactly.
Right? And that's like a decade later. So I think, I mean, ultimately, I think there's no right or wrong answers when it comes to these things. And hopefully, like, that's not what it sounds like we're saying either. Like, when we're talking about what we prefer, it's all just kind of, I think, are you fulfilling the goals you set out to fulfill? Like, in my case, one of my major goals is I never want to have quote-unquote business logic in my Swift UI views. And if I can use some kind of abstraction, whether it's a view model, controllers, or anything else, to kind of achieve that goal where I can have that logic live somewhere else for testability's sake, for just architectural sake, for just organizational sake, if I can fulfill that goal, then in my mind, I have created a good architecture, right?
Yep.
And then we can talk about naming and structure and so on. And every developer will have slightly different preferences there anyway. So it's all about kind of fulfilling the goals, I feel like. And once you do that, well, it's probably good enough and you can kind of keep iterating on the code base. And then as things move on and we learn more about the framework, Apple come out with new APIs and we all kind of develop new techniques and new ways of using Swift UI as a framework in for iOS development, we will probably change our minds and then we might need to tweak our architecture and change things going forward. But if we have achieved that goal of separating concerns and we have good modularity, then usually changing things in the future won't be that much work. We will be able to kind of tweak things going forward. And that's, again, why I focus so much on that kind of modularity and separation of concerns and making sure that I fully own the objects that manage my logic, because then I know I can iterate on them regardless of what happens to Swift UI itself.
Yeah, exactly. I think the main difference between Swift UI and UIKit or AppKit is that Apple is not prescribing an architecture, right? So with UIKit, it was always Apple saying, hey, you use MVC to make iOS apps, and that was it. But with Swift UI, they haven't really come out with, oh, you should use MVVM or whatever architecture. And I'm not sure how I feel about that. I've thought about it a lot, and I'm not sure if I would prefer for Apple to come out and say, hey, use this architecture for your Swift UI apps. We're recommending that you do it this way. Or if it's better to leave that up to the individual developers or teams. I'm leaning more towards, it's better to make the framework flexible enough where by you using a different architecture than the one prescribed, it doesn't cause you any issues, because that is the case with UIKit and AppKit. And it's one of the reasons why, in general, I do not recommend going with one of these really different architectures when making a UIKit or AppKit app, because you are fighting the framework to some extent when you do that. And I don't feel that way with SwiftUI. I feel like in that sense, and it's kind of ironic because we like to complain about how we can't customize things in SwiftUI, but that's usually with visual styling of views in general. But in terms of architecture, I feel like SwiftUI is way more flexible than AppKit and UIKit. And I'm leaning towards thinking that it's a good thing that we can have this flexibility and not have to fight the framework if we want to do something different.
Yeah, I do really agree with that. And I think Apple's role, as far as I see it, and my kind of preference is that for Apple to build really flexible tools, but to not make them too opinionated and to not make them too hard to customize, right? And we've talked about that, like you said, about how we really wish SwiftUI would be more flexible when it comes to the actual styles and what kind of UIs you can build with it. But when it comes to the state management system, that's really, really flexible. And it gives you so many different tools. Like, you can use state objects and observable objects. You can use state and binding, and there's environment. Like, there's all sorts of things you can use. And in the beginning, like, for example, when I'm running Swift UI workshops, that part of the workshop when I go through the state management system is usually the more complex part that takes a while for people to fully grasp, because there's so many tools in that toolbox. And that's the downside. Like, when you have a very flexible system, it can take a little while to learn and a little while to like figure out when do I use which tool, right?
Yep.
But the huge advantage is that it just gives you that flexibility and you have all these different tools that you might not use all the time. For example, the environment. Like, I don't use the environment all the time when I'm building SwiftUI apps, but every once in a while, I have a problem where it's like, oh, I need to share this value across this whole view hierarchy. Oh, the environment is perfect for that. And then I'm really happy that that API exists. So I do really think that if Apple can focus on building really flexible tools and then kind of let the community decide how to use them, that I think is the best situation that we can be in.
Yeah, I love the environment because it's one of the tools that enables developers to make their own custom views and make them behave like the system views, because you can create a modifier for your custom view, and what the modifier does is it modifies the environment that your view is observing, and you can change things through that. And I mentioned, I think, the custom sheet style that I made for the AirBuddy widget configuration stuff, and that's one of the things that, thanks to the environment and preference keys and whatnot, I was able to achieve that. And the call site just looks like you're using a system API. I think that's still one of my favorite things about SwiftUI. And I've been doing a lot of publish and plot stuff lately, which, for those who don't know, that's Jones static site generation tools. And I feel the same way about those. So I think you're going to be happy to hear that.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a huge compliment. Thanks.
Yeah, I've made some really cool extensions and things to help me. And I'm going to talk more about this project that I'm doing with them soon. But yeah, and I don't feel anymore like we did back in the day when we were complaining about customization of stuff in SwiftUI. I do still agree that customizing built-in system components such as list. I think list is definitely the worst component in SwiftUI, even though it's very useful and really neat, and it's improved a lot in how customizable it is. But when it comes to actually creating custom UI, SwiftUI is fantastic, especially my experience is mostly on macOS, but if you look at the AirBuddy desktop widgets that I've actually just shipped as a beta this week, they are all SwiftUI, and it's a completely custom UI, and it feels like it's a part of the system because I did a lot of work to make it feel that way. And you could argue that maybe it shouldn't be that much work to make them feel that way, but at the same time, like, you have the power to create these really custom UIs that, yeah, you could do with AppKit and with Core Animation, which I'll talk about in a bit, but it was a lot more work. And with SwiftUI, I feel like it's a lot easier. Like, the theming of the widgets is an environment key. Like, you change the enum value on the environment key and the drawing just changes. And that's really, really easy to achieve. So I do agree that particular system components like list and maybe not even button, because you can create your own button styles and they can do whatever you want. But yeah, there are some system components that can be hard to customize. But for people who like to create their own stuff, I really like SwiftUI for that. And the main downside with doing that, which is usually things like accessibility support, SwiftUI takes care of it as well, because you can create a completely custom view that behaves like a button, and you can add the accessibility representation and tell the system, hey, this is actually not this thing you're seeing on screen. This is actually a button, and here is the button that it is. And for accessibility tools like VoiceOver, it's a button and it behaves like a system button. So even that downside is not there in SwiftUI. So yeah, in general, I'm really happy with how it enables me to express my creativity.
Yeah, that's awesome. And I think you're absolutely right. Like, you can kind of look at it as, if you have a line and on one end of the line you have the completely system-based UIs, right? That where you're building a Mac app or an iOS app that just looks exactly like Apple's apps, just looks like the system appearance. It doesn't use any kind of customization. And then on the other end of that spectrum, you have completely custom UIs, like your widgets, for example, or my game, which is not using any system components at all, yeah. right? Like it's using a custom font, using custom buttons, custom everything, drawing sprites, animations. Like that's just completely custom, right? Where you end up in trouble, I think, when you're somewhere in between, when you want to take the system components and just tweak them a little bit, like just let me tweak this little aspect. And if Apple didn't think of that and add that as an explicit API for SwiftUI, then you're going to be in trouble, right? And yeah. I think that's the big difference with UIKit, where with UIKit, you could always like change the background color of any view or modify the layer if you wanted to and so on. Like that was not always advisable to do, but you could always do it, right? Even if yeah. it wasn't an explicit API for it. And I think that's kind of what's missing from SwiftUI. I did an episode recently of Swift by Sundell, the Swift by Sundell podcast with Chris Eidhoff, and we did talk about this quite a bit there as well, our yeah. kind of wishes for this year's WWDC for SwiftUI to become more flexible in this regard, like more easy to tweak system components.
Yeah, that was a really good episode, by the way.
Yeah, glad you liked it. So Rambo, now we've been spending, I don't know, half an hour talking about SwiftUI. What do you say? Should we talk a little bit more about SwiftUI?
Yeah, it's the SwiftUI podcast. Welcome.
I've been thinking about that recently. Like, you know, I've been doing so many podcast episodes about SwiftUI on my show, and we've been talking a lot about it on this show as well. But there's just so many things to talk about because it's like, it's almost like we are not reinventing iOS development. Of course, we're not. Like, we're still building things in a similar way, and we can reuse a lot of our code, and UIKit of course is not going anywhere, but it really feels like this whole big new world to explore. And I still feel personally like I've only scratched the surface of what mm-hmm. SwiftUI can do, and we talked about it in terms of architecture. Like we'll probably continue to invent a lot of patterns and so on about these things, and it just feels like there's so many things to talk about, even if it's just one UI framework.
Yeah, exactly. And of course, the web front end people are looking at us like, what? We've been using declarative programming for 10 years or something. But hey, let us have our moment.
Let us have our fun.
Yeah.
So what have you been up to with SwiftUI? I know that you've been doing some really cool things when it comes to mixing technologies, which we always like to do, right?
Yeah, it's something that I've been doing quite a lot of with SwiftUI and both AirBuddy and other projects. And I am dusting off Chibi Studio, the Chibi Studio codebase. Long time we haven't talked about this app here, which many people probably don't even know exists. But it's this app I have for iOS that I do with a friend of mine who's an illustrator, and you can create these cute characters. It's really fun. And it's a really fun project to work on because it can do whatever we want it to do. Like, it's not like AirBuddy where I have to worry about all of this different hardware and battery life and this very technically complicated stuff. It's just a fun app, and whatever fun idea we have, we can probably put in it as long as it's allowed in the App Store, of course. But we've been thinking about some changes to the app, and this is something that's been on the back of my mind for a long time, which is, do I want to adopt SwiftUI in Chibi Studio? I don't think the app has any SwiftUI. It's been a while since I like did anything in the app. The code base has been dormant for a while, but I've been picking it up again for some things that we want to do. And one of the big parts, or I guess like the most important part of Chibi Studio, is the canvas. So the place where you actually select your items and you put the clothing on the character and you move things around, scale things up, scale things down. And we've been thinking about making the canvas more like an actual canvas and more flexible so that people can add text and emoji and their own drawings with the Apple Pencil or stuff like that. And looking at how the canvas works today, it's not that it wouldn't be able to support all of that stuff, because it's all based on core animation, and core animation can do paths and it can do images and text and all of that stuff. But the way the canvas works and the way it's been architected, and even like the format that stuff is saved in, it wouldn't be easy to add all of this stuff, and it would probably break other stuff in the process. So, you know, John, when this question arises, The answer is always to just rewrite everything from scratch, right?
Of course, you need to add a couple of new features. That means like throw everything out and start over again. No, yeah. It definitely does not.
Yeah, so yeah, this is most often not the right answer. It might be in some cases, but in this case, it's probably not. And there will be some rewriting because my plan, and I think I'm going to do it, is to actually rewrite the canvas itself in SwiftUI, but the canvas in like the area of the display where you interact with your character and where you draw stuff and whatever. Like, it's not the whole like editor experience, which I don't think needs a rewrite right now. And in keeping with not rewriting too much, there's all of this content out there that's been made with GB Studio that uses the current format, and that's all based on core animation. So a chibi is just a CAE layer tree, and there's a bunch of like shape layers and gradient layers and masks and effects and whatnot, and that is what is rendered by the app. So you probably get where this is going. I was wondering, could I make the canvas in SwiftUI, which has all of this cool stuff, like you have shape and path, and that's really, really flexible. You can do a lot of stuff with that. But could I do that while still basing it all on core animation and using CA layers? And that was the thing I set out to answer. I did have like a challenge I put on myself, though, which was that I do not want to just like have a UI view or an NS view with a bunch of CA layers in it in a view representable or view controller representable. I wanted it to be, quote, native Swift UI.
All right, interesting. Because that would be my go-to approach, is that I would wrap the layers in an NS view or a UI view and then use the representable types to get that into the Swift UI view hierarchy.
That's too easy, John.
That's not the Rambo way.
Yeah, so I
doesn't involve any spelunking at all. How fun could it be?
Well, actually, what I'm doing doesn't involve that much spelunking. But anyway, So I thought about it, and if you think about what a CA layer is and what it does, so let's think about like the common types of CA layers that people use. Like, you have this basic, like the base CA layer class. You can have a background color, you can have a corner radius. The corner radius can be continuous, or it can be like the dumb corner radius, I guess. And it can have a border and a mask. Doesn't this all sound like stuff SwiftUI can do to you?
It does. In fact, I think there's already a lot of core animation things leveraged by SwiftUI under the hood, like to actually do those things.
Yeah, exactly. And if you think about the more, quote, advanced types of CA layers, you have the gradient layer. It can do three types of gradients, which happen to be the same three types of gradients that SwiftUI can do. But I guess it's not that CA layer can do the three types of gradients that SwiftUI can do. SwiftUI can do the three types of gradients that CA layer can do, because right. It's probably using a CA layer under the hood at some point. And you have CA shape layer, that's CG path, and you can have a fill and a stroke and a meter limit and a whatever, like those, I never remember like those stroke terms, they're complicated, but anyway, it has like a dash phase, dash pattern, and that's all stuff that the stroke style in SwiftUI does. So there's a huge overlap between what CA layers can do and subclasses of CA layer can do and what SwiftUI can do. So the answer is obviously I wrote a CA layer view, that it's a SwiftUI view, and you instantiate it with a CA layer and it renders the layer tree. And that's it. Simple. Done.
So how do you actually then connect that to the actual SwiftUI renderer?
Well, actually, so what it does is it reads the properties from the CA layer So it like gets the background color property from the CA layer, and if it does have a background color, it puts in the background modifier in SwiftUI with a color instantiated from the CG color from the CA layer.
And I
see. And if the CA layer has a mask, it will recursively pick up the mask layer and use another instance of CA layer view as the mask for the current CA layer view. So this view is recursive in nature because the CA layer is a tree, so you have the sublayers. So of course it will go over the sublayers and put them all in the correct Z order because CA layers have the Z position property. And it just goes through and, oh, is this a shape layer? Let me create a path, a SwiftUI path, and stroke it with the correct stroke and fill it with the correct fill that's specified by the CA layer. And it goes through and it does that. And you get a rendered CA layer on the screen that matches what the CA layer looks like.
So you're basically using the original CA layer as a data model to mm-hmm. render the SwiftUI view.
Exactly. So the CA layer then becomes a data model. And I've actually like created an internal wrapper that this view uses that's an observable object. And if any property changes on the CA layer, because CA layers are reference types, they're not value types. And when you're editing your chibi in Chibi Studio, what it's doing is it's changing properties on CA layers. So I, of course, need the canvas to re-render whatever has changed. So it does wrap CA layer in an observable object. And whenever a property changes, it will re-render whatever it needs to re-render through like the built-in SwiftUI invalidation mechanism. And it works surprisingly well. Like the biggest challenge I've had, and this sounds like a lot of work, like Rambo rewrote core animation in SwiftUI. It's not that, because all of the stuff that CA layers do, and there might be like some, like there are some more exotic CA layer types, like the array layer and the
replicator layer.
Replicator and the, yeah, it's not array, it's replicator. There are like particle systems, but I don't need those, like I only need the stuff we use in Chibi Studio, and it was actually not that much work. Actually, I think the biggest challenge, and it was one of the things that I had like as a goal and as like a requirement for this, is that heat testing must work correctly. So imagine like in Chibi Studio you have a character and there's like a head and there's a piece of hair. So the hair is all like pointy and there is a cutout in the middle where the head goes, of course. If I tap on the hair, I need the hit test to be perfect. Like if I tap the little corner of the little strand of hair in the right side, it should select the hair. But if I click in between these two strands of hair where the head is, it should select the head. So I can't have like a square hit test area. It has to be perfect, basically. So that was like the biggest challenge, but fortunately, SwiftUI has the content shape modifier, which I wasn't sure would be able to handle like really complicated paths, like a piece of hair from Chibi Studio, but it turns out that it can. So I have a little algorithm that goes through a layer tree and builds up the outer path that will match what the user would expect to be the hit test area for that piece, and it does all of the transforms to put it in the right place, and with that you can click or tap on the screen and select stuff.
Super cool. Yeah, but what an interesting solution. And it's kind of interesting where when I first heard you say this, I thought using a CA layer like that just as a data model, it kind of sounds a little bit wasteful. But yep. Then I started thinking about how actually core animation works under the hood, where it also has a model layer as the representation and an actual rendering layer. So yep. Every CA layer actually is composed by multiple layers that it also uses to manage the state and kind of the difference between what is on screen right now and what is kind of in the upcoming buffer, if you will, right? Mm-hmm. Like what are you currently mutating for the next screen update? Now, What's interesting here, though, is that now you're introducing another layer. So you're essentially like, you know, doubling the amount of layers that are being used here. And I'm wondering, did you do some profiling if this is actually faster than using something like UIView Representable?
I did not, but my main worry with the representable stuff is that it would be too easy. But you see, that's the thing. I'm not sure it would be easy to get started with, definitely, but I'm not sure down the road what other issues it would cause, like with things such as hit testing and the positioning of views, because keep in mind, I need the user to be able to pinch to scale up a view and scale down a view. And like, I know views are not that expensive, but chibis can have lots and lots and lots of different layers. So I didn't do any formal profiling. I did do some profiling of this solution as it is right now, which is very much in prototype stage. Like, the code is actually fairly decent because I started at this as a prototype, but already like thinking that this will probably end up in the app at some point. So it's not the prototype quality code we talked about earlier in the show. But I did some profiling, and one of the features that this view type that I created has is it can do different types of scaling for the contents of the layer it's rendering. And it can do scale to fit, scale to fill, stretch, or no scaling. And the test I did was to have it as set to scale to fit, and then I would resize the AppKit window that's rendering it and look at both CPU usage from the app and also the graphs for CPU and GPU on my machine. And it looked like most of the work was happening on the GPU. And I haven't done anything for that to be the case. It's just like the way SwiftUI works. So I was very happy about that. One thing I haven't tried yet is very frequent and broad invalidation. So like changing many, many, many properties of many, many CA layers in the tree in quick succession. I feel like that would be a case where it could be a problem, but it's not really something that happens in Chibi Studio. So this is very much like a solution I'm writing for Chibi Studio. So I really only have to worry about the stuff that the app does. And it doesn't really do anything where like I'm invalidating lots of properties of lots of layers at the same time. So I'm honestly surprised by how well it works. I started this as like, there's no way this is going to work. And like 2 hours later, oh my God, I just rendered a chibi with SwiftUI.
Yeah, it sounds like exactly the same experience as I had when building this SwiftUI based game that I've been talking about. Like, I also had very low expectations that it would actually be performant, and it turned out to be extremely performant. And I was just so happy to see that. And yeah, I think as a general purpose rendering framework, like SwiftUI is performing really, really well. Like we talked about, like when you want to build something completely custom, it is working really well for that. And in this case, also, you're doing like a custom actual rendering with your own layers as well. Like that's really interesting. And it's hard sometimes to kind of have some kind of intuition as to how performant a given solution will be. That's why I'm not sure whether or not your solution or the UIView representable solution would be the most performant. That's something you pretty much would have to profile to actually find out, because it's just so hard to kind of think about these things intuitively to think, you know, will A or B be the most performant? When we're talking about just a kind of classic UIKit based solution, I could very often these days say, like, I think like A or B or C, like these different options, which one would be the most performant, because I've just had so much experience dealing with that framework. But again, with SwiftUI, we're in this new world, and it's just so much of the kind of underlying rendering also happens underneath the layer of the framework, like under the hood. So it is sometimes really hard to guess what will be the most performant. Sometimes you kind of just have to build it out and see.
Yeah, exactly. And I did explore using the SwiftUI canvas view type itself, and that does work as well. And in that case, I was, instead of creating like my own view that will render a CA layer, I was just directly rendering the CA layer tree in the context that's provided by the SwiftUI canvas. So you can ask the SwiftUI canvas to give you a CG context, and CA layers have this render in context method that you can call. And I was doing that for the whole layer tree, and it worked quite well. In fact, I actually have a prototype here where you can like create a little chibi and click things and stuff. But the major problem with that was hit testing.
Mm-hmm.
I did get it to work, but it was very hacky, because the way I was doing hit testing was to translate the point that the user clicked or tapped on the canvas to a point within a layer tree that was constructed by putting all of the layers of the chibi in a root layer and transforming it off screen to be the same size and position of the canvas. So you can see how this is extremely hacky.
Right.
Like, it works perfectly right now. Who knows for how long? But the canvas view in SwiftUI, it just wasn't designed for this. So I felt, again, like the thing where I was fighting the purpose of that particular component. And I feel like Canvas is more like you want to do completely custom drawing, but not necessarily interactive, where the user will tap particular parts of your drawing or things like that, which is also something I think the biggest challenge overall with this is hit testing, because the thing I was worried about as well with the representable stuff was also doing hit testing, because the way it currently works in Chibi Studio is there's just a single view for the canvas, and hit testing happens all on the layer tree. And of course that works, but I wanted to be able to use SwiftUI constructs when implementing the canvas. So I wanted to be able to have a on magnify gesture on a particular item. So I would probably end up having to have a separate view representable for each individual item on the chibi. And I'm not sure how well hit testing works with the contents of the CA layer within that. I will probably end up doing a test with that, because you got me curious with your question about the profiling stuff. But yeah, I think the solution I came up with, even though it has a little bit of complexity, it's not that much though. Like, I think the whole thing is probably under 300 lines of Swift code. Like, it's quite concise. It's mainly just mapping between CA layer stuff and SwiftUI stuff, which is all translatable fairly directly. So I think this is the most flexible solution if I want to actually use all of the features of SwiftUI itself in the canvas implementation and not have to be bridging to UIKit or AppKit. Oh, and it also has the advantage that it's platform independent. I wrote it in a way where it builds for iOS, macOS, Mac Catalyst. So if I want to make like a native Chibi Studio for macOS, I can do that. And in fact, my test where you can assemble your chibi is a Mac app. It's not a UIKit app.
Very cool. And the canvas view that you mentioned there earlier as well, like you mentioned, that's based on core graphics, so with CG context. And then you're drawing also on the CPU. That's also something to keep in mind, right? Like, obviously, like we talked about, it's important to profile these things and not make too many assumptions. It might be that that's great, like, to do it in this case, but in general, the reason I like core animation so much, and I try to use it as much as possible when it comes to these custom drawing scenarios, is because then I get that really, really performant drawing with GPU acceleration, with out-of-process drawing that core animation supports, and it just tends to give me a more performant result that scales better across multiple objects than what core graphics does. That doesn't mean that core graphics is terrible, you should never use it. It's great for, like, raw image manipulation. And like you said, like when you're drawing something that is like an actual like canvas, like a painting or something, where you're drawing all these shapes and you just want to compose them into an image, that's great for core graphics. But for this type of drawing, I would also kind of more lean towards core animation, just as you've done.
Yeah. I'm not sure about the CPU drawing aspect though. I didn't look at the graphs like I did with my other solution. But I remember I was seeing fairly negligible CPU usage when resizing the window. My favorite test is to have it in an AppKit window and just resize the window and see, because it will then have to invalidate the canvas because it's scaling up everything. And it wasn't using like scale effect, it was actually like re-rendering the canvas. And I was seeing very low CPU usage. So I think there might be some quote magic going on. And I remember I looked into what the context was that was given by the CG context that came from the SwiftUI context. And it was like some unknown context type. It wasn't like a regular device RGB screen context or like a PDF context. It was like I don't know what this is. You go figure it out. So it probably, I don't know, maybe it's using like some metal thing or whatever. So yeah, I'm not sure about that. But again, this stuff has to be actually looked at with instruments and not with us speculating.
Yeah, absolutely. I just, like, every time I see CG context, I'm always thinking CPU drawing, but you're absolutely right. It could be that they're using some separate implementation under the hood, or simply that they're like caching things or drawing things to a texture or something like that. Like, there are many different optimization things you can do with graphics. So it's not saying that just because you use this type, like the canvas or a core graphics context, it means that you don't have performance code. No, absolutely not. And there are many, many different ways to do it. So like you said, you have to definitely inspect and profile before drawing concrete conclusions. But also to our earlier point about projects as well, is that if something is good enough and it works for your use case, then perhaps it's just good enough, you know? Like if your solution that you've built with core animation and doing that kind of custom hit testing and so on, if that works for your use case and it doesn't feel too hacky or hard to maintain, then maybe you don't need to explore so many other options. Maybe it's interesting to explore another one just to validate your conclusions or to see like, well, how does this compare to something else? But at the end of the day, we don't want to build like five different implementations of every single feature we work on. That's not really a good use of our time. So sometimes you just have to call it to say, this is good enough. This is performing well. It's not pushing the CPU or GPU too much. Let's just move on and actually ship this. It could also be that the reason you're seeing low CPU usage is because you have an M1 Max, right? That just, it just crunches through those drawing commands like, no problems.
Yeah, and a Mac in general, right? Because this is, at the end of the day, an iOS app most of the time. But if you think about it, unless iPadOS 16 has completely resizable windows or something, most of the time in the actual app, and like we have like it's a fairly good distribution, like 50-50 between iPad and iPhone users for Chibi Studio. If you are using it on an iPhone, It's not like the window is being resized and having to re-render at 120 FPS. It's you're tapping something and you're like dragging something. It's not like, so performance, of course, it's important just because like it let's not be wasteful and waste the user's battery and stuff, but it's not like super critical. It's not a game engine where it has to render at screen refresh.
Exactly. And that's kind of what I meant with like, if it's good enough, it's not just like, oh, I finished the code, let's ship it, let's not profile it, right? Like you do want things to be performant and respectful of the user's battery life and device in general, like for things to be performant and run well. But, you know, there is a point of diminishing returns usually, right? Where sure, you could maybe make it like 0.1% faster, but would anyone notice? And would you actually gain anything from doing that? So it can be a fun kind of academic exercise, but is it actually going to be give you any practical value? That's kind of always the big trade-off with performance tuning, is that you have to kind of pick a target, I feel like, and say, if I manage to achieve this, then that's good enough, and then I can move on. Because you could just kind of performance tune something into infinity. Like there's just so many things you can do when it comes to performance tuning and make things faster. There's almost always a faster algorithm to be found. But the question is that actually going to be give you any practical benefits, right?
Yeah, I think the advantage of doing like the work you mentioned is having headroom, so you can increase the complexity of things in the future without it becoming a crisis where all of a sudden you add this one new thing and oh my god, now it's not rendering at even at 15 FPS or something. So it is good to do a little bit of that work to have some, even if it's just to have this headroom that you can then take a little bit of that performance back from your users when you want to add some cool new feature. But yeah, in general, it's all trade-offs, like always. And just to not forget to mention it, it always depends.
Yeah, of course. We have to say that on every single episode.
Of course.
And I think like having headroom is important, like you say, but I think another thing that is very important and that goes into doing this kind of profiling work is to know where your bottlenecks are, right?
Yeah.
Like even if you are not going to address every single bottleneck because you don't have time or because you feel like it's diminishing your returns, if you know where the bottlenecks are and you can document that somehow, even if it's just like a code comment in your algorithm or in your drawing code, then that can be great because that means that if you do end up with problems in the future where something is not rendering as well as it should, well, you have already identified the bottlenecks before, so you can kind of then do that work to optimize that.
Yeah, of course.
Great. So this has been a really fun episode, I think. I mean, I love to talk about these things. I could talk about rendering and performance tuning and so on like for hours and hours with you, Rambo. In fact, I think if we would sum up the hours we've actually spent talking about these kinds of topics over the last 183 episodes, then it would be quite a lot of hours, I think.
Oh, yeah.
So thanks so much, everyone, for listening. Hope you enjoyed this conversation. And we will be back again next week, actually, for our pre-WWDC poker special episode. Woo. Because, of course, even though we are now recording two episodes per month instead of every single week, we do, of course, want to play poker before the WWDC keynote so we can make some predictions and play and see who's going to win this time, who's going to make the best bets as to what Apple might release during this year's conference. So really, really exciting. Stay tuned for that coming up next week, probably on the 1st of June, maybe the 2nd, we'll see, but coming very, very soon. So we will talk to you then. Thanks again for listening and say goodbye, Mr. Rambo.
Goodbye.